This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of If I Live by Terry Blackstock, published by Zondervan and read by Kate Rudd. This book is lovingly dedicated to the Nazarene. 1. Casey. Fried rice isn't worth dying for. I never should have come inside. I should have stuck with fast food so I could use the drive-thru, order into the box, and get my food through a window. But I needed to use the restroom and wash my face after hours on the road, and I was sick to death of burgers, fries, and salads. I stopped at a Chinese restaurant nestled within this shopping center, figuring not many diners would be here this time of day. The lights are usually dim in Chinese places, so with my long brown wig and the glasses I'm wearing to hide my eyes, I thought I could pull it off. But the media has shown multiple sketches of how I might be disguised. The circular booth in the corner is full of college students. A girl looks at me, then whispers to her friend, and now everyone at the table is staring at me. One of them gets on the phone. Trying to look calm, I amble toward the front door. The waitress runs after me.
Food almost ready.
I'll be right back, I say, though I have no intention of returning. Outside, I hurry up the sidewalk. I reach for a door to the anchor store and glance back. Two of the girls have darted out of the restaurant and are talking animatedly on their phones. I glance toward my car. I can't get back to it now. If those girls see me get into it, the police will know what I'm driving and I'll have to get a different one. I'm running too low on cash. I couldn't have gotten this one without Dylan's help. I go into the department store and look around for somewhere to hide. In the back corner of the store, I see the sign for the fitting rooms. I slip through the door and find an empty dressing room with a door that locks. I lock myself in and sit on the bench to catch my breath for a minute, my mind racing through options. The college girls saw me enter this store. Any minute now, the police will be here and I'll be arrested. My heart pounds and the sutures on my shoulder feel like they're ripping. I wonder if they're getting infected. I readjust my sling, but then I realize it's a dead giveaway. It may even be how the students spotted me. I take it off and stuff it into my bag. I also pull off my wig and pull my dyed black hair up into a ponytail. Keeping my arm close to my ribs, I find my baseball cap in my bag and pull it on, ponytail through the back, and take off my glasses. I shrug off my outer blouse, leaving only a tank top beneath it. I shove my sunglasses on and consider myself in the mirror. I do look different than I did 5 minutes ago. Fatigue weighs me down, probably from blood loss when I was shot a few days ago, but I have to keep moving. I hang my purse strap over my good shoulder, then pile the clothes hanging in the dressing room over my arm as a prop. Never mind that they don't fit me or look like anyone in my generation would wear them. I just need to look like a normal shopper until I can get out the back door. I venture out of the dressing room, careful with my wounded arm. Feigning interest in a sale rack, I glance around for the girls. I don't see them, so I look out the front window. I see a blue light flashing. They're here. I head toward the back, hoping I can find a door somewhere. There's a swinging door with a sign that says Employees Only, and I drop the clothes hanging over my arm and push into the back room. I hurry past boxes and racks of clothing, a broom closet and a mop bucket, and an employee bathroom. I see a back door for deliveries. I open it and look both ways up the alley. There's no police car here yet. No one is out here. I cross the alley and walk, as weak and winded as a heart patient, through a patch of woods that takes me uphill until I have a view of the parking lot. I sit on a stump behind a cluster of trees, watching the college kids talking to the cops and taking selfies with police cars in the background. This will be all over social media within 20 minutes. Cable news will pick it up, and maybe even network news. This town is ruined for me now. I have to leave. I keep walking through the trees. On the other side of the woods, I come out in a bad area. There are men loitering on corners and lightly clad women approaching cars stalled in traffic. I see a girl with a curly blonde wig on, wider than her small shoulders. I've had black hair, brunette, blonde. I've had a red wig, a blonde wig, a brown wig. None of them have had frizzy curls. No one would be looking for that. I walk down the hill through the trees and wait for the girl to come back to the cracked sidewalk. Excuse me, I say. Can I talk to you? She looks like she's too busy for me, so I add, there's money in it. I have her attention now, so she turns to me.
What is it, honey?
I like your hair. Is it a wig?
Yeah,
she says, touching it.
Thanks.
I wondered if I could buy it off of you. The woman laughs.
What? You want to buy my hair?
I'll give you 200 cash. She hesitates.
Four.
250. She huffs.
I paid a lot for it. I'm not just giving it away.
Okay, I say, digging for my wallet. 300, take it or leave it. She sees my other wig in my bag.
What, do you collect wigs or something?
Yeah, it's kind of my thing. I'm an actress. She grins and takes her hair off, revealing short-cropped brown hair with blonde highlights. She could be a soccer mom with that look. She ruffles it so it doesn't look so flattened and reaches for the cash. I really liked this wig, she mutters. Surely you can get another one for a lot less, right?
I wouldn't sell it if I couldn't.
Thanks, I say. I really appreciate it. I take the wig and stuff it into my purse, which is full to the brim, and when the girl turns away, I go back into the woods. I dust it off, inside and out, then put it on. It feels big and floppy. I look into my phone and see that it doesn't really look that bad. I actually kind of like it. With my sunglasses on, I don't think anyone would guess it was me. I sit on the ground for a while, wishing I had gotten my food before I had to run. I'm starving, but it'll be a while before I can eat. After a couple of hours, I need to use the facilities again. I go back through the woods to where the wig lady works the street and see a convenience store with barred windows. I go in and try the bathroom door, but it's locked, so I have to ask for a key. They have a TV on behind the register, and I already see my face and the footage of me in the restaurant. They're warning people that I'm in the area and that I may be armed and dangerous. The cashier doesn't even look at me. She hands me the key and I hurry to the ladies' room. I take a mental inventory of what they'll know from security video in the restaurant. My purse, for sure. It's big and black and nondescript. But I unload everything into the sink, turn it inside out so that the plaid lining is on the outside, and put everything back. I look down at my shoes. They're gray sneakers. Surely those won't stand out any more than my jeans will. I realize only then that the bandage on my shoulder is visible without the shirt I was wearing over my tank top. And I don't have a different shirt to put on. Someone knocks on the door and I yell out, "Almost finished!" I look in the mirror again and sigh, then pull out the shirt I took off earlier and sling it over my wounded shoulder like a towel. I hear more sirens, see blue lights flashing on the glass in the window above my head. Are they still looking for me? I'm sweating as I open the door and step out. The woman waiting snatches the key out of my hand and shoots inside. The cashiers are still distracted with the police cars driving by and the news of drama in the area. I see a rack of T-shirts, so I grab one and a pack of peanut butter crackers, step up to the counter, and clear my throat. One of the cashiers glances at the stuff instead of at me. This all?
Yes,
I say. She rings me up, gives me a receipt. I throw the T-shirt over my shoulder, too, and go outside. Around the corner of the building, I pull the T-shirt on over my tank and throw my blouse and the long brown wig into a trash can. I stuff a bag I find in there down on top of my things to cover them. At least now if they search me, there won't be immediate evidence that I'm the one who was seen in the restaurant. I go back through the woods, hoping I can get to my car. The police cars should be gone from the shopping center for now. Have they quit looking for me? Spent, I walk down the hill and around the stores to the front parking lot and, without hesitating, head purposefully to my car. I get in and don't even look around before I pull out of my space. I see one police car across the parking lot, but his lights are off. I don't see the driver anywhere outside. I pull out of the lot into traffic and drive away. When I'm far enough away, I let myself breathe. 2. Dylan. My car is still sitting in Dallas, right where Casey left it before she was shot by a child molester who dealt drugs. Dex drops me off at it, and I glance around for some sign of Keegan and Rollins, the detectives determined to kill Casey before she exposes them. But I don't see them. The car is parked on the street behind the house where Casey got shot. From where we sit, I can see between two houses to the molester's yard and driveway. There are no police cars there. In fact, it looks as if no one is home. The truck in the backyard that would have proven some of his crimes has been moved. I hope the police towed it to their lab.
You need to replace that phone, pretty boy,
Dex says just before he drives away.
You need to have the same number Keegan will use to reach you. They'll figure out it's a different phone when they can't track me anymore. But they won't know what you did with it. You can claim it got broken or lost.
I appreciate that Dex is worried about it, since I duct-taped the phone to the bottom of an 18-wheeler to throw Keegan and Rollins off my trail. If I hadn't done that, both Casey and I would be dead by now.
I guess I can replace it and use the same number. Go to the cell phone store. They can transfer the number in minutes. If Keegan doesn't have the serial number or whatever it is he needs to track the new phone, you'll buy yourself some time.
Dex leaves, and I head to the cell phone store and do what he suggests. Keegan is probably ballistic that I led him on a wild goose chase. I would love to have seen the look on his face when he realized he'd been duped. Once I have the phone, I fight the urge to call Casey on her burner phone or send her an email on our secret account. I need to keep my contact with her as infrequent as possible to give her a chance to get farther away. I can't give Keegan any opportunity to get close to Casey again. Instead, I do what Keegan might expect and give him a call. He picks up on the first ring.
Where are you, Dylan?
His voice is sharp, angry.
I'm in Dallas, I say. My phone broke, and I was so busy going after Casey that I didn't have a chance to replace it until now. I noticed that, he says. You missed all the fun. I was there before you were,
I say, because I know that he knows it already.
I showed up right after the gunshot, and I took off after her. When I didn't find her, I went to the hospitals, checked every one, showing her picture around, seeing if she had checked in for that gunshot wound.
He hesitates a moment.
We know she went to a convenience store bathroom, he says. She was gone before we got there, but the blood trail ended. She must have patched it up or had somebody come and pick her up. I don't know, I say. She seems like a loner. I doubt she has friends who would break the law to rescue her. I wouldn't put anything past her, he says. I wouldn't put anything past you. Maybe you're the one who helped her.
The muscles in my neck tense, and I feel a headache coming up the back of my head.
I didn't let her escape, I say. I told you I was looking for her. So why did they think you were me? Those people that shot her. I didn't tell them I was you,
I say.
I just showed up and they acted like they'd been expecting me. So what's the deal with those people? They were arrested by Dallas police,
Keegan says.
Can you believe that? Somebody finally helps us get close to her, and now Dallas is hampering our investigation by arresting them for some kind of child abuse. Some kind of child abuse? I ask. You mean the molestation of a 7-year-old girl? Trading her for drugs? Okay, they had it coming. But it sure threw a wrench in our case. Automatically, they're sunk as witnesses. But I've got lots more. People she worked with. People who knew she was involved with that guy Cole Whittington who ran off a cliff. People who rented a room to her.
I don't bother telling him that Casey had nothing to do with Whittington's death. Casey was trying to keep the man alive.
So the Trendles are in jail? And their dealer, all of them? That's what I said. Child's in foster care? My understanding. So are you heading back home?
My acting skills aren't what they should be if I'm going to keep lying to him, so I'd better get off the phone. I quickly tell him a few more things I plan to do to find Casey in Dallas, and he accepts that. He sounds eager to get off the phone, too. He doesn't really want or need my help. He wants to have no one else but Rollins there when he finds her, so they can do whatever they want to her. Then he can claim that she was armed and fired on them, and they had to shoot her. When I get off the phone, I ask myself, what would I be doing if I were honestly chasing her? I would probably pay a visit to the Dallas police detective again, as though I don't yet know about the Trendles' arrest or where little Ava is. If nothing else, I can at least put Casey's fears about the little girl to rest. 3. Casey. I don't even know what town I'm in, but I check into an off-brand motel and change my bandage. The TV plays while I try to nap, the news channel cycling the latest alerts every 15 minutes or so. It gets old. I doze until a new breaking alert pulls me awake. Possible indictment for Casey Cox. Let's listen in to the district attorney of Caddo Parish in Shreveport. I sit up and squint at the screen, then grab the remote and turn it up. The camera locks on to the man standing at the bank of microphones. I've seen him before, in some election or on the news talking about me. I'm not sure where. I've already missed his opening sentences.
We have just completed a grand jury investigation into Casey Cox's part in the murder of Brent Pace in May. Our grand jury has returned an indictment against Ms. Cox, who went missing just after the murder.
I let out a rush of air as though someone had punched me in the gut. I knew this would happen, but now I've gone from fleeing arrest to fleeing a felony indictment.
We believe Miss Cox went to visit Mr. Pace during her lunch break on that day, and that when he answered the door, she stabbed him multiple times.
I'm not shocked that they believe this. I saw the brutality of his murder, after all. It just sickens me that so many believe I could do such a heinous thing to my closest friend.
She went into the house as he lay bleeding. And she left footprints, fingerprints, and other physical DNA. She then took the knife back to her car where it was later found, along with Mr. Pace's blood, which was apparently on her hands as she started her ignition and opened and closed her door. The blood trail continued at her apartment as she tracked it up the stairs to her place of residence. She changed clothes and fled in a taxi to the bus station, where she took a bus to Durant, Oklahoma, with some stops in between, and later to Atlanta, Georgia, then to Shady Grove, where she lived for some time.
It's chilling to hear him tracing my steps like this. I go to the window and look out, expecting the parking lot to be swarming with cops, but it's not.
Many of you are aware of Miss Cox's actions in Shady Grove, but I would caution you to consider the brutality of the murder she committed before she went there. After the events in Shady Grove, which are not relevant to the Pace murder, she fled again to Dallas, Texas. Most recently, she was sighted in Dallas, but she evaded capture once again. We believe that Casey Cox is armed and dangerous, and that she is particularly good at disguising her appearance. Her eyes are particularly notable, however, so we advise citizens to go by the almond shape of her eyes and not the hair or makeup she might be wearing. She is 5 feet 5 inches tall, about 120 pounds, and we believe she is recovering from a gunshot wound to her right shoulder.
I touch my shoulder and look in the mirror.
We advise citizens who see Ms. Cox to contact the police at once and not try to capture or follow her on their own. Again, she may be armed and dangerous.
I sigh. I don't own a gun or a knife. I don't even have a pair of nail clippers.
Finally, Miss Cox, if you're listening, we advise you to turn yourself into the police department closest to wherever you are, because continuing to evade the law will make it worse for you. We will find you, and when we do, we will see that justice is done.
Make it worse for me? How much worse can it be than being killed before I can tell the truth? I shiver at the way he's addressing me, and I fight the urge to turn off the news. He cannot see me, I tell myself. He can't trace my television signal. He's just trying to get into my head. I back against the wall across from the TV and stand there as the reporters question the man.
Was Casey Cox involved in the death of Cole Whittington in Dallas, Texas?
That death is under investigation. I can't comment on that case at this time.
I groan. They know the Trendles did that. The truck is ample evidence.
Are there investigations into other deaths in places where Casey Cox has been? Again, I'm only here to comment on the Brent Pace case.
That would be no, I bite out.
Have you been able to isolate a motive in the death of Brent Pace? Witnesses say they were close friends, and we know he did call her that morning. Do you know whether he invited her to come over on her lunch break? Do you know yet if they'd had a fight or anything that might have prompted such violence?
We haven't yet found the exact motive.
What about the timeline? Macy Weatherow, one of the local Shreveport anchors, asks.
The ME said Pace was killed at least a couple of hours earlier than Cox's lunch hour.
That was an approximation.
But is it possible that someone else killed him since we know Cox had been at work all morning?
I catch my breath, relieved that at least one person is questioning my guilt.
Cox fled. The murder weapon was in her car.
He turns to the next reporter's question as if that settled that. The murder weapon was planted in my car. To this day, I have never seen it. Macy's voice rises above the questions shouted by others.
Friends describe Miss Cox as a kind and stable person. Some of her actions in Shady Grove and also in Dallas seem to bear that out. She rescued a kidnapped girl and her child. She allegedly talked a man down from committing suicide. How certain are you?
As I said, her DNA is at the crime scene. The knife was found in her car. Mr. Pace's blood was on her car and in her apartment.
But some are saying that she may have just found the body, that if she'd murdered him, she would have at least tried to cover it up.
If she wasn't the one who did it, why wouldn't she have called 911 to report finding his body? Instead, she fled and has evaded capture ever since. That's all for now,
he says, backing away from the microphone. But another reporter draws him back.
How does the indictment change things? It doesn't put you any closer to finding her. Until now, she was a person of interest in a murder. Now she's the main suspect, and the indictment charges her with a Class A felony and a Class E felony. Thank you, everyone.
The DA leaves the podium and walks away as people shout more questions at him. I slide down the wall until I'm sitting on the floor. My phone rings. I pull it out of my pocket and see that it's Dylan. Of course, who else could it be? No one else has this number. It occurs to me that he's in trouble, too, now that I'm indicted. His helping a person under indictment automatically moves him into another category of crime. I don't want him to get in trouble, too. I let the phone ring to voicemail. He doesn't leave a message, but sends a text instead.
You've been indicted. Have you seen the news?
I don't answer.
Are you okay?
I turn the phone off and take the battery out. I have to sever the link between us before it gets him killed or imprisoned. Too many people with ties to me have had catastrophic consequences already. I have to end this. It would be so easy to just turn myself in. I could walk into the TV station here, or the police station. I could let them arrest me. But then Keegan and Rollins would show up to take custody of me, and I would probably wind up dead. It's insane how trapped I am. Until I was 12, I always believed anything bad that happened could be solved.
Life had a way of working out. Justice prevailed. There were people like my dad who made sure of that. But when I found my dad dead, lies blended into truth. What was up turned down. What was in went out. What made no sense was suddenly assumed. Evil people were believed over a stupid 12-year-old girl traumatized by her father's alleged selfishness. I kept all of that inside me for 10 years until I shared it all with Brent. He went after it like a hound with a ham, and it cost him his life. A while later, I check my secret email account. Dylan has left me emails.
I don't know if you're okay. I need to talk to you. I figure you've heard about the indictment. Call me back anytime, day or night. If you don't, I'm probably going to go ahead and turn everything we've got over to the DA. At least it'll be a way to stop where all this is heading. We need to strategize. I've learned some new things about our nemesis. Please call me. I can't sleep.
I squeeze my eyes shut and let the tears drip mascara down my face. I hate the heavy makeup that runs when I cry. I hate the wig that bobs when I walk. I hate that I've lost so much weight that my jeans are too big, but I can't go shopping to buy more. I hate the homemade stitches and the unceasing pain in my shoulder. I almost don't care what happens to me. But I do want to see Keegan and Rollins pay for their sins. They have to. Otherwise, all of this, my father's death, my friend's death, and the last few months of living like a frightened criminal, is a waste. None of it will mean anything. I drop my battery and phone into my purse. When I stand, my image in the mirror startles me, as if someone I don't know is in the room with me. I pull off the wig, sick of it, and climb into bed, pull the threadbare blankets up over my head. I don't want to turn myself in, and I don't want to kill myself. But I do wish I would just die in my sleep. 4. Dylan.
Dude, I can help you if you show me what you got.
Dex is sitting on my couch, studying the evidence I've pulled up on my computer.
Any way we can spread this all out? Look at it all together?
I can't even sit. I'm so agitated.
When I was in CID, we used to have these big whiteboards with all the evidence on every case, all the connecting dots, every significant item we logged. You could easily see what you had with a glance. Sometimes we'd just stare at them and something would click.
Dex reaches down to scratch his prosthetic leg, a gesture I find interesting. He talks of phantom pain in the amputated limb, so I guess he also has phantom itches.
Hey, you remember that case you were working on, that sergeant who was poisoned? Yeah, Sergeant Mintz. A hated man. Had so many persons of interest I thought we'd never get to the bottom of it. Every member of his unit had said they wanted to kill him at some point. So how did you track all the evidence on each of the guys with motive?
I think back and recall the large whiteboards lined up on each wall of our office.
We had a different board for each person of interest, with everything we gathered about each one. Lines connecting, overlaps, issues they'd had with him. That case was tough because we knew the kind of poison that was used to kill him, but being in a foreign country, we couldn't get cooperation from business owners where the poison might have been bought. We even found the place we thought they probably got it, and they had security footage, but for a while we couldn't get even that. But you did get it, right? Eventually? Finally we did. Then the guy who we thought the video showed buying it wound up having an alibi. He was on a mission when the murder happened.
I walk to the longest wall in my apartment and envision setting up whiteboards in here.
It helped that it was all up there on the boards, and we could figure out which soldiers were tight, which ones might have teamed up to pull this off, which ones had an integrity deficit and might be drawn to others like them. Right, Dex says. I remember. Turned out there were two guys who had sociopathic tendencies. Yeah. There had been complaints from some of the others that they had shown unnecessary cruelty on some of their missions. We started tracking them and found out they were getting heroin from a local dealer. We searched their bunks and found some residue of the poison. We got both of them. And they were court-martialed. You bet they were. They're still serving life sentences. So why don't you have any whiteboards, man?
I sigh and drop down next to him on the couch.
I've thought of that, but I can't have any of this out in plain sight. What if Keegan or Rollins drops by? I wouldn't be able to hide it. The apartment's not big enough, and if, God forbid, they figure out what I'm doing, they could raid the place and find the evidence easily. What if you made it something you could roll up? Only pull it out when you're working on it, like rolls of paper?
I stare at the wall again, trying to imagine if that could work. Actually, it could.
Yeah, maybe. You could take pictures of it, too. Send them to Casey so she could study it. It might help both of you figure out what else you need to get this over the finish line and get her name cleared.
I nod. I feel like I'm working handicapped, since most of what I'd normally do in an investigation can't be done.
So how is her shoulder?
I sigh.
I don't know. She isn't taking calls. Hey, I did the best I could, but it's not my best work. You did great.
Dex pushes up from the couch with his good hand and points to me with his hook.
Come on, let's go. Where? To Office Depot. We'll find something that can work. You need your tools, dude. You gotta get this done. Okay, let's go.
We go to the office supply store and peruse the supplies I might be able to use for my board. I drop some rolls of white paper into my cart, then I grab some different colored markers.
That gonna work?
Dex limps up to me as I'm checking out.
Yeah, I can keep the papers rolled up when I'm not using them.
Dex grins.
I don't think I've ever seen you so excited about office supplies, pretty boy.
He's right. I can't wait to get them home. Back in my apartment, I unroll the white paper in rows and tape them to my wall. When I'm done, my whole wall is covered with one massive worksheet. When I finish working on it each day, I can roll it up and take it with me, hidden in the trunk of my car, then quickly put it back up the next time I need to see it. Dex is a genius. I get to work with my notes and all the evidence we've found, all the people we've compiled evidence against, all those who've served as witnesses. I think better of putting up the names of Alvin Rossi and Gus Marlowe, who have been hiding from Keegan's group, and instead I put the names of the cities where the retired cops are living now. Jackson and GR for Grand Rapids. If Keegan ever discovers my makeshift whiteboards, I don't want them to be at risk. I work all day after Dex leaves and into the night, making lists and connecting dots, circling overlaps. I print out pictures and scotch tape them to the paper where I need them. Yes, it does give me a much clearer picture. I take snapshots of the wall and email them to Casey. Then I turn my couch and coffee table to face that wall, and I sit there with my feet up and my hands behind my head, staring. My gaze darting from one clue to another. We need a smoking gun linking Keegan and Rollins to one of the murders. I look up at the names of three people who have been murdered. Andy Cox, Brent Pace, Sarah Meadows at least. There has to be something somewhere. Until I find that, I can't be assured that Keegan and Rollins will pay for those murders. They'll only be charged with extortion and money laundering, and they may even skate on those. That's just not enough. Armed with renewed purpose, I get to work, wedging my mind through the cracks that I see opening. Casey is depending on me. I will find something. I have to. But later that night, as I dip in and out of sleep, in that limbo where memories lie in wait like more IEDs, my mind reminds me why I will fail. A phone rings in some other place. My childhood home, which looks like a war zone. What has my mother done now? I take the call and throw on my clothes and then head out to help her since she said it was an emergency. Wishing I had at least brought along a cup of coffee, I drive toward where she waits. It's always an emergency. I survived two IED explosions when most of my buddies came home in body bags, but my mother's dramas are the dominant forces in my days. I turn a corner and see her. She's driven her car into a ditch, and she's staggering along the road in front of it, ranting on her phone. There's a parking lot on the other side of the ditch, so I slow down until I see the entrance and turn in. I park behind her ditched car, and her yelling into the phone continues as I get out of the car.
Mom, I say, but she doesn't hear me. Mom, I shout.
She swings around, dropping her phone. She curses and goes after it, stepping into mud.
What took you so long? Are you hurt?
I ask. Do I look hurt? Just help me get the car out so I can go home. I stand on the other side of the ditch from her, looking helplessly at her car. The front end is smashed. The hood looks like it's been folded in half.
It's not drivable. We have to get a tow truck.
I look around.
Did you call the police? Was there another car involved?
I don't know, she says, as vague as ever. I'll get in and you try shoving it from behind while I gun it. I go back to the parking lot entrance and cross to her side of the ditch. She's standing partially in the road. People are swerving into the other lane to keep from hitting her.
Mom, step onto the grass. Come on.
She wipes the mud from her phone onto her baggy jeans leg, then tries to make another call.
Who are you calling?
Your father! She shouts, as if I'm the one who's the problem here. But he's probably still passed out and won't answer. He could get me out.
Mom, nobody can get you out of here, least of all Dad. I'm calling a tow truck.
Her breath reeks as she leans toward me and screams, I need that car, Dylan. Get it out of that ditch now. I don't have money for a tow truck.
Mom, lower your voice.
If you'd get up out of that bed now and then and get a job, I might have cash for a tow truck. But no, you got the PTSD and can't do nothing. And I'm left holding the bag. No wonder they kicked you out of the army. My jaw tightens and I feel myself going rigid. Instant, white hot rage.
I didn't get kicked out. I was honorably discharged.
Because you were a mental case.
I'm not the one who just drove my car into a ditch. I bite out. Mom, go sit in my car and I'll take care of this.
Don't you call the police, she says. I'm warning you, don't do it. I figure there's no reason to call them since no one else was involved, so I watch her wobble to my car and finally get in on the driver's side, like I would ever consider letting her drive me home after this. I do a quick Google search on my phone and find the name of a tow truck company. I call them and they tell me they'll head this way. My mother has fallen asleep, her head against my headrest, her mouth hanging open. I'm going to have to wake her up to move her to the passenger seat, which I dread. She'll scream at me all the way home. I lean back against my fender, waiting for the tow truck as her voice echoes through my brain. Mental case. Kicked you out. The heaviness in my chest jolts me up, and I gasp for breath. I'm drenched with sweat. But relief eases through me as I orient back into my own place where her drunken mantras can't reach me. I'm not a mental case. I'm not going to fail. I'm also not alone. God is on the case with me, fighting this battle. As I cling to the image of his sword slashing the evil around me and around Casey, I fall back to sleep and, this time, dream of victory. 5. Dylan. My alternate burner phone rings as I stare at my evidence board. I click it on.
Hey, man.
Dude, Dex says. I was just reading the newspaper online, and you know how they update during the day when they have a new story?
I guess,
I say, though I rarely go to the site to read the news online. I'm pretty much a paper kind of guy.
So they just put up a story about a guy they found murdered in town this morning. A German guy who owns a dry cleaners. Turns out he's one of the business owners I saw Keegan talking to when I was following him.
I'm quiet for a moment, trying to absorb what he's saying.
One of the guys you thought was an extortion victim?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't hear what they were saying, but I saw him go in and talk to the owner. I watched through the window. I saw the owner give him an envelope, and I could tell it was cash because Keegan seemed to be counting it. He was just one of many, but I remember him. Now he's dead.
I get up from my perch on the arm of my couch.
Okay. Good catch, I say. This could be something. They said he was found like 3 hours ago. Body could still be at the crime scene. I want to go see if I can get in. What if the dynamic duo are assigned to that case? We'll see. You want me to tail them some more?
I think about that for a moment.
I don't know. They'll probably be hyper-vigilant today, looking over their shoulders. Maybe today's not the best day. Let me get back to you.
All right. You know how to find me,
he says. I thank Dex and hang up, then I pace my floor, trying to think. I open my laptop and go to that online newspaper site and find the guy's picture. I print it out and stick it to the paper on my wall, write, extortion victim. I go to the stack on my kitchen table and look through it for the report Dex gave to me about the people he thought might be extortion victims Keegan contacted on the days Dex was tailing him. I scan down the list and find the man who was just killed. I get the address of his business.
Good work, Dex,
I whisper, then grab my keys and head out. The police cars are still there when I get to the site, and the property is taped off, along with the street in front of the building. I park curbside as close to the crime scene as I can get and look at the surrounding businesses. There's a sandwich shop across the street, a liquor store next to it. Next to the dry cleaners is an alteration shop. There's a camera outside the sandwich shop that might have security video. I wouldn't be able to get it since I have no official connection to this case, but there are other ways to get information. I walk along the crime scene tape, then cross through the rubbernecking traffic to the sandwich shop. I go inside. It's crowded with reporters sitting by the window, watching the activity across the street. There are no empty tables. I walk to the counter and check out the employees. There's an older man who looks to be in a sour mood, but he has an air of gravitas, so I go to his end of the counter and lean over.
Excuse me,
I say.
You the owner?
Yes,
he says. The line is over there. No, I just need to ask you a few questions.
I show him my police credentials, and he comes closer.
I've already talked to the police. I don't know anything. I don't want any trouble.
I'm not police,
I say, realizing that if he's one of the extortion victims, he could have a sharp distrust of cops.
I'm a PI. I'm working with police on a related case, and I wondered if you could tell me if anyone has pulled the security video from your camera outside.
Yes, they got it,
he says.
Could you tell me if it showed anything?
What time Mr. Brower got to work this morning? Anyone who might have gone there before it opened?
He looks from side to side, then shakes his head.
I didn't look at it. I don't know what they got.
I don't really believe him.
What time did they take it?
About an hour ago.
So he was found at 7:30 this morning. You're open for breakfast, right? So you saw the activity and didn't think about checking your video?
He's sweating now, and he looks scared.
I didn't think about it. Do you want to order something or not? Can you at least tell me what time Mr. Brower usually comes to work?
He gets there around 6:30 every morning. Opens at 7.
Did you see anyone going in there before he opened?
No, I didn't see anything.
Did anyone come in here for breakfast who might have been over there?
No, no one.
This man is irritating me.
You're sure of that? You know for a fact that no one who came in here had anything to do with him? How would you know that?
I know my customers.
I'm not going to get anything out of him. He must be afraid I'm one of Keegan's henchmen and that if he reveals anything, it will result in his death too.
I'm busy,
he says.
Have a nice day.
He disappears to the back. I sigh and look around, hoping another employee might talk to me. I get in line and wait my turn. When I get to the front, I order a club sandwich. As I'm paying, I ask the girl,
"So what's going on over there?"
She looks around as if making sure her boss doesn't hear her. The owner of that dry cleaner's was murdered, she whispers. Employees found him when they came in. She leans toward me. Shot. Scares me to death. I came in early this morning, too. It could have been me.
Was he shot inside or outside?
Inside. They found him in his office. Execution style is what I hear. He was a nice man, too. Came in here for lunch every day. His poor wife.
Has she been here since he was found?
Yes, the police notified her and brought her down. It was horrible. I could hear her screaming all the way over here.
The wife. I have to talk to the wife. She would know if he'd been threatened. If she knows about the extortion, then maybe she'd be willing to help me.
I'm scared to work here now, she whispers. What if the killer comes back?
She flits off to prepare my order, and I stand there with my back to the counter, looking through the plate glass to the cleaners across the street. When she brings me my bag, I take it and go out to the crime scene tape, where media people are clustered. I scan the uniformed officers, looking for someone I know. Finally, I see a guy I went to school with. I didn't even know he was a cop. I walk the perimeter of the tape. Thanks, I say. He turns, sees me, and laughs out loud as he reaches for my hand. Dylan! Great to see you, man! You too. You in a uniform. Who would have thought? I know, right? I heard you were in the FBI or something. The military version. I say, Army CID. But I'm out now, discharged last year. I'm contracted to help the department on a case right now. Working solo, huh? Sounds nice. Can be. Were you the first responder on this case? No, I didn't get here until later.
He lowers his voice.
Owner shot in the head, probably with a .38. Keegan would carry a .38, like most cops, but he wouldn't have used his department-issued weapon. Any shell casings found? Not to my knowledge, but the CSIs are still working, and I don't know what they've got. I haven't been inside. Does his family have any idea who did this? No, his wife was out of her mind, upset. Brutal. Where is she now? Someone took her home.
I look around at all the activity.
Who are the detectives assigned to the case? I ask him. Stamps and Logan.
I think about that for a moment. Keegan would have manipulated the evidence to keep them from figuring out it was him.
So has Keegan been by? Rollins? Yeah, some of the other detectives have come by. Curiosity, I guess. Boom. So Keegan made sure that any hair follicles, any sweat, any prints they found of his had a reason to be here. Dylan! How you doing, man?
I turn and see Kurt Keegan, Detective Keegan's son, who I also went to school with. We were pretty good friends in high school, but I haven't seen him but once since I got back stateside. I shake his hand as if nothing has changed. For all I know, he's tight with his father and is part of Keegan's criminal circle. But he was always a good guy when I knew him. Nothing like his dad. The pull of money is always a changemaker, though. I shoot the breeze with him, hoping he doesn't mention to his dad that I was at the scene.
So I hear you've been working on Brent's case, he says. My dad was a little irritated that they hired you. We're helping each other out,
I say, evading.
Yeah, I bet. He likes to micromanage. I would imagine you're butting heads. Just hang in there. We should have lunch sometime. Catch up.
I give him the same number his dad has and tell him to call me when he has some time. I don't know quite what to think of what he said. Is he feeling me out for his old man? Or is he really clueless? Later, I look up his address and drive by. He lives in an apartment not much better than mine. There's a vehicle in his parking space, a pickup that's probably 5 years old. If he has money, he's not spending it on things like that. But then, neither is Keegan. His toys are all carefully hidden and are owned under aliases. Nothing I've seen yet has implicated Kurt, but I'm not stupid enough to think that his dad left him out. I hope he calls me so we can have lunch. If he's involved in Brent Pace's death or anyone else's, I'll take him down, too.
I have no nostalgic allegiance to murderers.
6. Casey. The Craigslist ad I answered is for someone to earn up to $2,000 a month working from home, and I figure the fewer people I encounter per day, the better off I'll be. I did a phone interview already with the wife of the attorney who was hiring. She didn't tell me much about the job I'll be doing, but she asked me to come in for an interview with her husband. I take special care on my makeup and wear my frizzy wig, hoping neither of them will recognize me from the news. At least my voice isn't recognizable, since the media has only been showing my pictures. In a strip mall, I find the office. Billy Barbero Esquire, says a bronze sign next to their door. It's not an upscale law firm, just a one-man show. And when I step inside, I realize just how downscale it is. His wife, the woman I talked to on the phone, is probably 50, wearing a pair of jeggings that don't flatter her fleshy thighs, and a baggy Metallica sweatshirt. Her desk is covered with binders and stacks of paper, with only a small area cleared out for her to write on. Hi, I say. I'm Liana Winters. I have an appointment with Mr. Barbero.
Yes, I talked to you,
she says, looking around her desk for something. She pulls a clipboard out from under some notebooks and hands it to me.
If you don't mind, fill out this application so we'll have all your info. He's with a client right now, so it'll be just a minute.
As I take the clipboard and sit down, she yells out,
Billy! Liana Winters is here!
I look up, startled. Through the door, he yells back,
Who?
The girl we're hiring, she yells back.
I'm encouraged that she's already identified me as the new hire, but I can see that it's not a conventional law office. I fill out the application with fake information about Liana Winters, including employment history. I don't know what will come in handy for this job, since I'm not sure what it entails, but they could clearly use a receptionist or administrative assistant. I truly was an office manager at my job before Brent's murder, and I was good at it. So I write that down with a fake address and hope they won't try to check my references. Somehow, I don't think they're organized enough. When I'm almost done, the door opens to his office, and a young woman with a service dog, a German shepherd, comes through the door. She looks a little like Natalie Portman, but she's wearing dark glasses. She must be blind. March, can you call my ride for me?
Sure thing, hon.
The man I assume is the attorney is in a wheelchair, the narrow kind with no armrests, and he wheels out rapidly behind her. He has long gray hair to his shoulders and is wearing a t-shirt and jeans with a hole in the knee. Marge calls for the ride as the blind girl says some parting things to the attorney, and I wait quietly, finishing my application. When Marge hangs up, she says,
He's not answering, sweetie.
Figures, the blind girl says. He knows I need him. Maybe he's heading this way. I'll wait outside and keep trying him. She lets the dog lead her to the door. Once she's out, I get up and step toward the attorney.
Hi, I'm Liana.
Barbero shakes my hand.
Come on into my office, he says. Help yourself to our coffee maker if you want some coffee. It's all DIY around here.
I don't really want any, so I decline and follow him in. His office looks like a tornado hit it. Binders are stacked halfway up the wall, filling every space behind his desk. Half of his desk is covered with papers, but he does have a clear space in front of where he parks his chair.
So, Marge hired you, did she?
I guess she did. He looks down at my application, nods approvingly, then says,
So let me tell you what we do here.
Okay.
I represent disabled clients. The gal you saw in here is one of them. We sue establishments that aren't following the Americans with Disabilities Act.
He stops and chuckles.
We have hundreds of lawsuits in progress all over the country. Unfortunately, one of my best researchers just passed away. Pneumonia. Nasty case. Didn't expect that.
I'm so sorry, I say.
Anyway, we need to replace him.
What does a researcher do? I ask.
I need you to find violations of the act. Hotels that don't have wheelchair-accessible pools, mainly. That's our biggest moneymaker, and they're easy to find.
I nod. So you want me to go around to the local hotels?
No, ma'am.
He says,
not physically. You'll use Google Earth or Google Maps. Pick out a city and zoom in over every motel listed in the area. And if you can't see the pool lift beside the pool, we'll sue them.
Really? I ask. It's that easy?
Yes, indeed.
He says,
the law is the law.
He types something on the computer, finds a Google Earth satellite image of a pool behind a hotel, and shows me what a pool lift looks like.
It's rectangular like this. If you see anything like this, just skip over it. If you don't see one, call the motel and ask them if they have a pool lift. Then give me the name of the hotel and their address and phone number, and I'll sue them on behalf of one of my clients.
I think of all the motels I've stayed in, and I've never seen a pool lift. But I haven't been looking for one. So you don't have to be a customer of the motel to sue it?
Nope. Under the law, we can sue them without ever going to the place. It's an important service to the disabled community.
I stare at the satellite image. I think I can do this.
All you need is a good internet connection. You'll get paid by the number of leads you give me. $10 a lead.
It seems easy enough, but I won't know how much that will make me until I try it. I can start right away.
Then welcome to your new job,
he says, reaching out his hand again. I shake it and get to my feet.
Just email your leads to us and keep up with them yourself to make sure Marge pays you the right amount. She's kind of a mess. You can bring them here if you want to make sure she gets them.
Okay, I will. I look forward to working with you, Mr. Barbero.
Call me Billy. We're not formal here.
Okay, Billy. He wheels out behind me as I go back into the front office, smiling. Thank you, Marge, I say.
When's she starting? She asks him.
Now, I think she'll be a go-getter. Good hire.
I'm feeling good about this when I step out of the office. I'm walking to my car when I see the blind girl and her dog waiting on the sidewalk. I walk over to her. Excuse me, I heard you were having trouble getting in touch with your ride. She looks just to the left of my face.
Yeah? Who are you?
I'm Liana Winters, I say, confident because she can't see my face. The Barbaros just hired me to be their researcher. If you still need a ride, I'd be happy to give you one.
Really? She asks. That's fantastic. I can pay you.
I can't get Uber because I can't see the app. I ought to get Billy to sue them. I was going to call the cab company next, but Siri isn't cooperating on my phone. She introduces me to her dog, Butch. He seems friendly, but focused. I lead them to my car, not certain how much help they need. I clean off my back seat and put my emergency bag into my trunk so the dog will have room. Then I open the door for her. She seems about my age and has a friendly expression on her face. I'm sorry she can't see, but I'm glad she can't see me. She lets the dog in, then easily gets into the front. I slide into the driver's seat.
Where to?
She gives me the address.
What did you say your name is again?
Liana Winters. I say, and yours?
Claire.
So you're one of Billy's clients?
Yep, he was a godsend. He saw me in a Starbucks getting coffee and asked me if I wanted to earn some cash.
So you work for him too?
No, he kind of works for me. I'm a plaintiff. He uses my name on some of his lawsuits. He has a stable of disabled people whose names he uses. Gives us a cut.
Oh. I'm quiet for a moment, not sure if that sounds legitimate. I hope she's not being taken advantage of.
I figure we're helping disabled people everywhere, you know? The lawsuits just make it more possible for us to have access to things, and it's a good living for me.
I decide not to judge their motives or intentions. It must be legal or they wouldn't be doing it, I tell myself. She lives in a nice neighborhood in a fairly new house. I pull into the driveway, and she gets out and opens the back door for Butch to hop down.
Thanks so much for the ride. It wasn't awkward and painful like rides can sometimes be.
Glad to, anytime.
Really?
She asks.
Because I'm always looking for people to drive me.
Sure. I tell her my phone number. She hands me her phone.
Will you put it in my contacts list so Siri can find you? That is, if she's in a cooperative mood. I navigate to her contacts and type my info in. Before giving it back, I grab a Kleenex and wipe off my